afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, March the 10th, 2016. 12:11 coming up on 12:12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Scott Spears along with you on the Now program. And today we are going to pay tribute, as we've done several times this week, to a gentleman I had on this program many, many times over the years, a fellow Ohio guy from Lima, Ohio, the man who really put tennis on the map for so many people, certainly when it came to broadcasting, Bud Collins, who passed away sadly last Friday at the age of 86. Bud was an original, without doubt. He was always fun to talk to. And how can you forget the clothes? The clothes did not make the man, but the clothes will certainly be remembered, certainly the pants, for the rest of our time. In this hour, we are going to be joined very nicely by Bud's wife, Anita Ruthling Clausen, who's going to speak with us momentarily. And then in the bottom of the hour, for the last 15 minutes of the program, we're going to be joined by Don Dell, who broadcast with Bud during the 70s and 80s on PBS and NBC, also very in-depth and well-known sports agent. Before we get to Anita, Bud's wife, I do want to play a clip of Bud on this program. This was Christmas Eve. It's a funny thing. One of the first interviews I did with Bud was on Christmas Eve morning, 2008. This is Bud answering a question. I asked Bud what it takes to be a good broadcaster. Here's Bud Collins.
What makes a good broadcaster?
You just throwing those tough questions. I don't know what makes a good broadcaster. I think you have to have a distinctive voice, and I think I do. I think you want to be very well informed on what you're broadcasting, and I think you don't want to take yourself too seriously. After all, it's doing sports isn't Edward R. Murrow or something like that, or Cronkite. So you have to. I feel you have to have a little sense of humor. And not really take it too seriously, because sport is wonderful, but there are many more important things in our country.
Very well put. We now go to Bud Collins' wife, Anita Ruthling Clausen. Anita, are you there?
I am. I'm disappointed I didn't get to hear Bud's remarks.
Oh, you didn't hear those?
No.
Oh, well, we will try to patch that in for you.
I wanted to know what he said made a good broadcaster.
He basically said, don't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah, that sounds like Bud.
Yeah, it's just sports, and there are other important things going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Anita, you were... I want to put this right, because I've known you for a while now, too. We've been in contact through the internet. You were really Bud's protector. What made you feel so close? I mean, obviously he was your husband, but you had a real loving relationship.
Well, he was just the most incredible man I've ever known. He was goodness personified. He never got upset or angry. We never had an argument. He treated everybody gently, kindly, equally. He could be with kings or dukes or duchesses, and the kid that empties the wastebasket. There's a sweet story from Wimbledon where his desk was at the end of a row, and at the end of that row was a big wastebasket, and the kid hired to empty it during the fortnight came along on the first day, and Bud said, "And who are you?" That's the way he introduced himself, or wanted to find out people's names. So the kid looked startled, and he said whatever his name was, Joe or whatever. And then every day after that, during the fortnight, Bud would have a little chat with him and say, good morning, and thank you for emptying my wastebasket. And at the end of the tournament, there was a little note on Bud's desk from this kid, and he said, "Dear Mr. Collins, you're the first person in my life that's treated me so courteously and made me feel important. I'll never forget you." Isn't that something?
Mm.
I mean, that just sort of sums up Bud. This kid was just emptying wastebaskets, and Bud made him feel important.
Well, it's interesting because, and I confess this to Bud many times, that I did not know a lot about tennis. I liked tennis. I enjoyed it. But I always liked Bud Collins. And I remember when we first got in touch, it was, I think, maybe 2 days before Christmas Eve, 2008, and I'd been trying to reach him for a long time, and he called, and I never thought we'd get him, and he came on Christmas Eve morning, at like 8:30 in the morning. He was very unassuming. I think he was maybe the only person in the world who didn't know that he was Bud Collins.
I think that's absolutely true, so true. And I didn't really answer your question about my protectiveness, but people were always overwhelming him with requests, and he never turned anybody down. He always was helpful and kind and generous with his time. And I just felt sometimes that he needed somebody to play interference for him. But he was so kind. He wanted to help everybody. So if he'd had his druthers, he would have just done everything for everybody. And he pretty much did. And you're so right. He is the only person that didn't realize how incredible he was. He was so modest. I received over 2,000 emails since he died. And I just can't believe the overwhelming response. I even got a message from folks in Rapa Nui. The more common name for that is Easter Island. It's one of the most remote places on Earth. And we visited there in 2011, and these people remembered and just wanted to pay tribute to Bud. I couldn't believe it. It was just incredible to me.
You know, and I must admit, not being a gigantic fan of tennis, that one of the first things that attracted me to Bud Collins was the way he dressed. You couldn't miss it with mm-hmm. the pants and everything. But once you listen to him, he was so fascinating, and he didn't take it seriously. He did his job without question, but he understood that this is tennis, and sometimes it's not the most exciting thing in the world. So come with me. I'm going to liven it up. And he did more for tennis, I think, than anybody has.
Well, that's right. And Mike Lupica says that he's the single most important person in any single sport in the history of sport, because he just really changed the whole perception of tennis. When he came along, it was a very stuffy country club sport, and he did want to have fun. And his tailor, Charlie Davidson of the Anderson Club, suggested at one point that he would make him a pair of pants, and he had to promise to wear them. And because he looked boring with his white trousers and blue blazer. So he made these pants, which today you wouldn't even notice. They were just a madras cloth, nothing too startling. But he wore them to a Davis Cup tie in Cleveland. And he was going up the stands to the press box where he was doing his TV, and people were starting to whistle and say, "Love 40, and aren't you cute?" Things like that, because in the 60s, that was just totally unheard of. So at first he was kind of chagrined, but by the time he got to the top, he said, "This is fun. I'm having fun. This is great." And then the tennis went on long that day, and he was going to one of the very fancy country clubs for dinner, and his wife said, "You can't wear those in this place." But he couldn't change, so he did, and everybody looked askance, but it was fantastic. It was really his hallmark, and thanks to Charlie Davidson. And the thing is, what we make fun of them, but they were really serious trousers. We bought fabric in the different countries that we visited, and we brought that fabric back to Charlie Davidson, who would make the trousers. And they were beautiful, and he always dressed elegantly. It wasn't a comic shtick or anything like that. He really looked good. And so I was very proud of him. As you said, the man didn't make the clothes don't make the man, but in this case, the man made the clothes.
Absolutely. And I hope you can hear this, because I want to go back to 2008. Bud told the story of how that all came about with his clothes. I want the audience to hear that. This is Christmas Eve, 2008, Bud Collins on this program.
Now, speaking of not taking yourself too seriously, I have to ask this question. I'm sure you've been asked this many times, but one of the signatures of Bud Collins is the clothes.
Well, that's true.
The very loud clothes, the very loud way that you dress. Where did that all come about?
Well, it is a long story. It goes back to 1966, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just off Harvard Square. There's a tailor named Charlie Davidson, who's a fine friend of mine. And I came in there one day in 1966, and he said, "You look awful on television." I said, "What do you mean, Charlie?" And he said, "Well, you're wearing white trousers and a blue blazer, and you look like some guy at a yacht club." And he said, "I just happen to have some material, just got in, and I'll make you a pair of trousers, and if you don't like them, I won't charge you for them. But you have to wear them." Now, this was a Madras red and white plaid, which would not, you wouldn't look at it twice today, but in 1966, I looked at it and said, when he made them, I said, "Charlie, I can't wear those." And he said, "You promised." And my wife at the time said, "You can't wear those." I said, "Well, I promised Charlie." So there was a Davis Cup series in Cleveland, of all places, and I was covering that for the Globe. And as I entered the stands, I wished it had been rainy so that I could have worn a raincoat to cover those pants. But I started to walk up the grandstand of the press box, which was at the top. And as I walked, I heard whistles and people screaming, oh, look at that, and so, that sort of thing. I thought, gosh, I wish I could just fall into a hole. But then I got up to the top and I sat down, took my seat, and I said, well, that was kind of fun. And so Charlie continues to be the guy who makes most of my trousers. Some are off the rack, very few, however. And usually what we do, my wife and I, my wife is a great woman at anything, but she has a sense of clothing, and wherever we go, we buy the fabric, and we bring it, if it's interesting, and we bring it back to Charlie, who makes the trousers. So he's made some from material from Bhutan, which is a Himalayan kingdom we visited once, and from Thailand, and from Zimbabwe when we covered Davis Cup there in 2000. Also some Aboriginal designs from Australia, and Maori design when I covered the tournament in New Zealand. So that's how it goes, Scott. And some people think it's ridiculous, and other people like.
Bud Collins from 2008. Anita, how did you meet Bud?
Well, first of all, I have to say, I've learned his stories, right?
You had it down pretty good. That was pretty good.
Well, I was trying to keep it short, but anyway, yeah. And then on his website, I had designed one section that was out of Bud's closet. And in that section, it has a caption under each pair of trousers that explains where the fabric came from. He has about 52 pairs of those. Anyway, go ahead. How did we meet?
How did you meet?
We met through mutual friends, Tim Leland of the Boston Globe and his wife, Julie Hatfield, also worked at the Globe. They all worked together in that era. And Tim, by the way, is the person who founded the Spotlight team at the Globe and won Pulitzers and went on to Glory. And thankfully, that movie won the Academy Award for Best Movie. But anyway, he knew Bud very, very closely. They're dear friends. And Bud was mourning the death of his wife, who had died of a brain tumor after they had only been together 4 years. So he was very lonely and sad and so on. And Tim just told me about him. And he told me about him, and I said, I don't think so. What would we have in common? I know nothing about sports, and I'm not interested in tennis. I had grown up on a ranch in New Mexico, and we didn't do tennis. So then he changed tact, and he said, oh, but he loves to travel, and he loves music and art and stuff like that. And I said, oh, okay, I'll meet him. And we met, and 25 years later, we were still wonderfully perfect together. He was amazing. We were together 25 years, and from the day we met, it just clicked.
When Bud was working for NBC and Tennis Channel, what was your life like with him?
Well, those were separate eras. He worked for NBC for 35 years, and they were very nice days because we had everything. You know, everything was taken care of, and transportation and hotel, and it was just a wonderful time, and he had his role of interviewing the players and being on the broadcasts and so on. But things changed, and I thought they were treated him terribly with the firing. But anyway, he bounced back and worked for ESPN for a couple of years, and then Tennis Channel. And Tennis Channel was wonderful to him. Ken Solomon said, as long as Bud wants to be on the masthead of this channel, he's going to be there. We're never going to let him go. And that was very, very nice for Bud, because he deserved that. He'd worked in the business for 55 years. He'd created the business, for heaven's sakes. I mean, he's the first person back at WGBH that got tennis on television. So I'm just glad that Tennis Channel was so wonderful to him the last few years, and he felt included, and it was very, very nice. They did a beautiful documentary on him, and the day he died on Friday, the 4th, Ken told me that for that day it was going to be the Bud Collins Channel, and they did several hours of tributes to him. It was just wonderful. They treated him really, really well, and it was exciting because we traveled everywhere. We went around always to the four majors and to the Davis Cup ties, and so we had a great life. And every time we'd go someplace, we'd stay a little later or come a little early so that we could see some of the local art or whatever, and travel in the country. We traveled a lot in Australia. We saw more of Australia than most Australians, and we've driven across the country there. It was just a wonderful life. I loved it. I just loved it.
And Bud, I remember talking with him in the early days on the program. He loved to work. He was always ready to go to the U.S. Open or Wimbledon or mm-hmm. anything like that. And then, I don't remember the year, but an injury befell him.
He had that quad tendon rupture in 2011 at the U.S. Open. So life really changed after that. That's when his decline started physically, and it was brutal 4 years. So.
Well, I remember we had Bud on, I believe in 2011, and here's a little clip of Bud talking about that injury. From 2007. Here we go.
Bud, one thing missing this year from Wimbledon for the first time in many, many years was you.
Oh, well.
Now, for those who don't know, where have you been, Bud?
Well, my advice to everybody is don't fall on your face.
Mm.
That's what I did during the U.S. Open last year. I tripped and fell, and as a result, got myself in a situation where I've been in the hospital a long time, in and out for 10 months, 9 surgeries, and so I'm enjoying Wimbledon and anything else on Tennis Channel there's nothing much I can do about it except do my exercises. I'll probably be back next year.
Is the 9 surgeries, Bud, is the prognosis good?
The prognosis is good, but it's a little tricky. Have to accept what it is.
Anita, what happened?
Well, he actually ended up having 12 surgeries. It was a very serious rupture of his quad tendon, and then what happened was, as very frequently in hospitals, he got infections. And so then it got much more complicated, and he needed skin grafts and flap grafts, means they take a piece of muscle and flip it over the knee, because the knee has very little skin and fat to heal, and so they needed more. And it was just very, very complicated. Poor Bud. And he never complained. He was just so stoic and good and calm, and it was really, really sad. But we did go back to Wimbledon one last time in 2013, and we're treated royally. We were in the royal box, and it was a beautiful occasion. It was so perfect for Bud, and so that was nice.
Did he know that had essentially brought an end to his career, because he loved to work?
I know. Well, he always thought he'd go back, and this past year when he was suffering from so much dementia, his basic personality came through. He was always asking me to get his computer because he needed to get his story written on deadline, and of course there was no story to write, no deadline, and he just was imagining it. But He loved the work. He really, really loved the work, and he came along at just the right time. He could not have had the career he had today because newspapers are failing and so different, and television is different, and he just created something himself, and it was wonderful. He came along at the right time, and he covered everything in his sporting career. He traveled with Muhammad Ali to most of his fights. A lot of people don't know that. His first beat was boxing. He covered the Red Sox. He covered the Celtics. He covered the Patriots. He covered the British Open golf in England and in Scotland. And he covered wrestling. He did everything. He covered the dog show. So he televised the first Boston Marathon. You know, he was so, so versatile. And then finally he ended up in the niche of tennis, which suited him, and he made a brilliant career there. But he wrote op-ed pieces. He covered the war in Vietnam. He just did everything. He was a coach of tennis at Brandeis for 5 years, and one of his pupils was Abby Hoffman. So, you know, he just had a very versatile, wonderful career.
What was it like having Bud at home these last few years?
Well, it was bittersweet. He suffered a lot. It was a terrible end. I'll tell you, I'd much rather lose my body than my mind.
It was hard. Absolutely. Anita, I do want to play something, because one thing I found interesting about Bud when we spoke back in 2008, he was from Ohio, Baldwin Wallace, very proud of that. And he had talked about the last time he went back to Baldwin Wallace. Now, people have to think of the times here. This was during the Iraq War. And I think this speaks to Bud's versatility and how he let things roll off his back.
Yeah.
I asked him in this interview about if he got back to Ohio often. And here's what Bud said from 2008.
How often do you get back to Ohio?
Not very often. Not very often at all. The last time was in 2007. When I was asked to do the commencement speech at Baldwin Wallace, I was very honored by President Dick Durst. And it was an interesting time, though, because I got booed in many parts of that speech because I said we are living in an age of anxiety. I said anxiety, but also amnesia. I said we don't get history, and we disregard history. I was in Vietnam, and I said, well, thank goodness this will never happen again. And here we are in two wars. And so when I said that, though, I guess Ohio wasn't going the way that it finally went in 2008. And I talked about huge corporate salaries and how we need better public education. So I got a few hisses and a few boos, and it upset my wife. And I said, come on, don't be upset. I had to say those things, and I've been booed before.
How will you spend Christmas this year, Bud?
Well, we're spending Christmas.
What was that day like, Anita? And again, that's back in the height of the Iraq War.
I was just horrified at the treatment he got. We never did go back to Ohio after that. I wouldn't have gone. He said things that needed to be said. Things like, we ought to have better health care. We ought to have health care. We ought to have better education. We ought to concentrate on educating our kids instead of having wars. He talked about the corporate salaries, etc. I was sitting next to the president's wife, and she put her arm around me and said, he's saying things that really need to be said. He's very courageous. But he was booed by the students. He was booed by parents. I thought it was just appalling, appalling treatment. I hated it.
No, it's shocking. But it didn't seem to bother him.
No, I mean, it bothered him. It hurt him. But he's just, in his persona, in his public persona, he wasn't going to let anybody know that. He was going to say, no, I just bounced off my back and I've been booed before. You know, he said everybody gets booed. But I didn't like that treatment. I thought it was terrible. Very disrespectful, I thought.
Hard to imagine that happened.
And you know what? Not only that, we got death threats. For a year, we got hate mail. I couldn't believe it. That's why we never went back to Ohio. 1 year, we got death threats for 1 year. And things like, how's your friend, how's your pal, Jane Fonda, or don't ever come back to Ohio, you'll regret it, we'll kill you, you know, things like that. Well, it's horrible.
Oh, that's ridiculous. That's horrible.
Yeah.
That is horrible. Well, you know, I there's certainly no explanation for it, but at the time, people were acting awfully strange in this country, and hopefully today...
Yeah, they're acting even stranger now. Bud, actually, his last vote, I'll have to tell you, was for Bernie Sanders. He voted in the primary by absentee ballot, and so that's where his heart was. He wanted everybody to do better and not just have the rich do well.
Well, so. You know, something, Anita, I wanted to talk to you about, because when I started this off, and I do want to ask your favorite Bud memory here before we part ways in about 8 minutes, but
eight more minutes?
I hope it's not that much trouble.
No. I didn't realize this was such a long interview.
But one thing that was interesting about Bud was that in the last few years, you kept him available for people. And I thought that was tremendous, because we could all see through Facebook and things of that nature how he was doing. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the last pictures you had sent, he was holding a tennis ball.
That was when he was really dying, actually, yeah.
And it was...
It comforted him to have his tennis racket and a ball and so on. And it just... He was very agitated at times, and so I would give him that. It would be kind of like a blankie type thing, you know. It was just comforting.
In the end, how did it end for Bud? Was it just the dementia that eventually...
Well, I'm not sure, you know, what actually kills you in a situation like that. I think it was a combination. I mean, he had the Parkinson's, and the Parkinson's slows down your muscles, and eventually nothing works. But up until about a week before he died, he was very, very agitated, and it was very difficult at times. And he'd have nightmares and stuff. But then... the last week, everything was calmer, and everything was just very calm, and I wanted to be with him, so I was basically by his bed the whole week, and the morning he died, Friday, I ran upstairs to get dressed, and then I came back downstairs to his bed in our living room, and he was breathing very, very slowly, and my best friend came in, Jane Ann Phillips, a wonderful novelist who teaches at Rutgers. Anyway, she came in, and we were just standing there watching him breathe, and I was holding his hand, and then all of a sudden he didn't take another breath, and it was very calm, very peaceful. It was beautiful, so I was really, really glad that he had such a lovely death. I had candles in the room and beautiful flowers, and Berlioz's Requiem was playing, and it was just a lovely scene, and I had already spoken, because of hospice telling me that I needed to find a funeral home, so I had already arranged with somebody, and I called the guy, and I said, how long can I keep Bud here? And he said, you can keep him as long as you want. You can keep him overnight if you want. And I said, well, let's just keep him for the day, and you could pick him up in the evening, because all the children came and his friends, and it ended up like we had a wake, and I didn't even realize what I was doing, but it was perfect because we had a wake, and the people came and they paid their respects, and it was in our home. He was in his bed, you know, the hospital bed, but his bed's the past 8 months, so it was just perfect. And one person had the presence of mind, Vita Palladino, who heads the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center, where Bud's papers are. She brought a ton of food. I hadn't even been thinking of food, but we had so many people that it all got eaten up, and it was wonderful. It was just a really nice day, and then yesterday it was his cremation, and we're going to have a memorial service on June 17th, which is his birthday, at Trinity Church in Boston, and you're welcome, and anybody that wants to come is welcome.
Well, I hope I'll be able to make that, because I really did enjoy Bud. Do you think that Bud knew the end was coming?
Well, several times he asked me to do something to help him along because he was so miserable, but then once, you know, it's just terrible. I mean, this is a whole other conversation, but I think we need to do something in this country to not have people suffer for so long. And I'm just totally behind doctors helping in some way. They do it in other countries, and it just, I don't know. By the time he was really dying, he was in a coma for the last week, basically. He didn't say anything, or it was just very difficult. But for the last few months leading up to it, he was very miserable, and he knew he was dying, and he just didn't like being in the situation he was. Very difficult.
Anita, I want to say this, because I truly have to commend you for talking as frankly as you are, and I know this is very difficult. It's only been 6 days, but I think speaking as you are right now is very helpful to people, because people do go through it.
I'll tell you one thing. Well, let me just say this.
Go ahead.
Finally, we have a wonderful gerontologist on our street, who world-renowned guy, and he said to me at one point, it's time for hospice. So I called hospice, and I just think, Bud wanted to be at home, and I wanted him to be at home, and it was very difficult. I never got help at night, and I never, I didn't have much help. I had help some during the day. But anyway, I am so, so grateful to have kept him at home. He had a beautiful end of his life. I mean, it was perfect. There was life around him. People came in, they went out, there were smells of cooking. There was life. It would have been so grim in any institution. I don't care if it was the nicest one on earth. It just wasn't home. And I'm a huge advocate of keeping somebody at home. I know it's hard. I mean, I've just done it, and it's brutal, but it's really worth it.
How are you going to remember Bud Collins?
Oh, gosh. I'm just going to remember him as the kindest, most decent, good person I've ever known. He was joyful. He was loving. He was just so dear. I mean, there will never be another Bud Collins. He's just so good. He's just, I don't know right now.
Anita, I want you to hold the line for just 1 minute, because back in 2008, long ago, 8 years ago, I did ask Bud how he'd like to be remembered. And we'll play that clip here.
Bud, have you ever thought of an epitaph, how you'd like to be remembered?
Oh, geez. That's a great question. An epitaph. My wife just said in the background she wants a copy of this interview, and I know you'll supply it for her. An epitaph. Well, he tried hard and enjoyed what he did and made quite a few people happy.
And I think he absolutely did that. And I want to say on a personal note, that I don't know how many times I interviewed Bud over the years. It was quite a few. We did him via Skype. We did him on the telephone. I think the last time he was at Wimbledon, you set up a Skype for us.
Yeah, I think so.
And I have never seen anybody take care of somebody the way you did. And this is honest, listening audience. Anita would make sure Bud was in his pants when that picture was taken, and he looked good, and he had his sports coat on, and always let people know how he was doing. And that's hard, because there a lot of people go into cocoons and become private in that, and I know that had to be hard. Bud was a public person, but boy, oh boy, do I remember him fondly. And when the word came down Friday, I was just so sad, because he was a fun guy. I remember everything funny about him. I remember he was on one time talking about grunting in tennis.
And
he made that sound interesting. And I, like I say, you're in my debt forever for coming on today and discussing something very difficult.
Oh,
but
you're welcome.
Boy, are we going to remember him, and we're going to remember him well.
He's a wonderful person. I loved him dearly.
You stay well, Anita, and hopefully our relationship will continue on.
Okay.
Thank you, Anita.
Thank you, Scott. You were always terrific with him. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Anita Ruthling Clausen, the widow of Bud Collins. We're going to come back with Bud's broadcasting partner, Don Dell, in just a minute. Don't change that dial. You won't want to go anywhere. Everybody's talking about Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio, from legendary comedian Kay Ballard performing the fast food song.
Oh, there's one song that you like. I feel that, you know, fast foods have ruined the world.
Oh.
On the Champs-Élysées, on the Appian Way, there's McDonald's. By the Tomb of King Tut, there's a Chuck Full of Nuts and McDonald's. At La Scala, they sing by a big Burger King where the Styrofoam crackers go sweet. What's the use? What's the hell? I just heard Taco Bell went and franchised the wing at the Louvre. You know, I could go on and on and on, but that's it. I love things that are topical and that are kind of true.
The legendary actress and the voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid, Pat Carroll.
What would we do without gossip, for heaven's sake, Scott? Oh, it's naughty, but it certainly fulfills a certain catty side of all of us. Oh, good Lord. When you think of the gossip sessions you've had with friends over the years, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's like putting your hands in front of a lovely fire.
I would do anything you want, Scott. You know, I enjoy being on your show. But well, just let me talking and I keep going.
It's Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Join me. Scott Spears back with you, 49 minutes past the hour, and we're going to continue remembering Bud Collins, legendary tennis broadcaster for so many years. We thank Anita Ruthling Clausen, his wife, now widow, for joining us for the first part of this hour. We're going to go here in just a minute to Don Dell. Don was Bud's broadcasting partner for many years in the 70s and 80s on PBS and NBC during all those great tennis games and memories. We'll get those in just a second from Don, but I want to play again. 2008, Bud Collins was on this show Christmas Eve morning, and I asked Bud what it takes to be a good broadcaster.
What makes a good broadcaster?
You're throwing those tough questions. I don't know what makes a good broadcaster. I think you have to have a distinctive voice, and I think I do. I think you want to be very well informed on what you're broadcasting. And I think you don't want to take yourself too seriously. After all, it's doing sports isn't Edward R. Murrow or something like that, or Cronkite. So you have to, I feel you have to have a little sense of humor and not really take it too seriously, because sport is wonderful, but there are many more important things in our country.
Bud Collins on this program, Christmas Eve morning, 2008. So proud to be joined by his broadcasting partner for so many years, Don Dell. Don, how are you?
I'm fine, Scott. Thanks very much.
Did he have it right when it came to broadcasting?
Oh, yeah. Bud said it all very well, those three different characteristics. I think being knowledgeable is awfully important in broadcasting it well. And of course, Bud was really the single most historian of the sport. I mean, if you asked 20 tennis people in the world who is the best historian, all 20 would say Bud Collins, because he was an encyclopedia of knowledge, just walking around the tennis courts and going to the matches and broadcasting. And I had the great and good fortune. I broadcast five Wimbledons with Bud in the center court there, and Dick Edberg. The three of us were in. For 2 years, Bud and I did a twosome, and then the NBC added Edberg for breakfast at Wimbledon. which we did in the late 80s, and then late 79 and to 83, actually. And then I also did PBS with Bud for 10, 12 years. And we actually even got the six summer tournaments to all change their final dates to Monday night, and we did Monday night tennis before Monday night football back then. And Bud and I did the PBS Monday night tennis for, you know, about 6 years. And so those are really, really enormous occasions where you spend an awful lot of time with your broadcasting partner.
Tennis Channel did a documentary on Bud Collins that was tremendous just a couple years ago, and there was a story in there that I hadn't heard before about, I believe it was the first time Wimbledon was being broadcast, and you had a hand in this, Don, did you not?
Yes, I did. Was this the story about Roscoe Tanner?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, what happened was we were broadcasting the first breakfast at Wimbledon. NBC wanted to start with their affiliates in the West Coast at 2:05. The Center Court always started the finals at 2 o'clock, and they needed a 3 or 4 minute time lag on the West Coast to hook up all their affiliates, NBC did, back to America from England. And so they asked the committee, could we have the first ball hit at 2:05? And the Wimbledon committee said, of course not. We start at 2 o'clock. That's our culture. And so Don Olmeyer was the producer of the Wimbledon show that year, and I was working with Bud, and he got very agitated. Olmeyer is very worried about it, very upset with the committee. I said, don't worry about it, because at that stage, Roscoe Tanner was in the finals, and Tanner was a client of mine, and I said, don't worry about it, we'll work it out. And he looked at me like I was nuts. And I went to Roscoe the day before and said, you know, when you're sitting in that little room there, before you go on the center court, you're there with your opponent. You usually get there 3-4 minutes before the match starts. Suddenly get up and go back to the men's room, go to the bathroom, and don't come out for 3 or 4 minutes until it's about 4 minutes after 2 o'clock in London. And he said, fine. And he said, why? And I explained to him why, and that's what he did. And so the match started at 2:05 the next day. And of course, NBC was ecstatic, and Wimbledon never quite understood what had happened. But it was, and then Bud, I swore Bud to secrecy, and then 20 years later, he wrote the damn story in the Boston Globe in one of his columns. So then it became public knowledge. But Tanner really was the reason that the match started 5 minutes late.
Of course, everybody, when they think of Bud Collins, he had a great niche, the colorful pants. People remember him well for that. What was your take on that?
Well, Bud loved, you know, he loved people, first of all, his nature. And he had a great sense of humor. He loved the crazy clothes because it attracted attention. And he liked to be a little bombastic on the show. He loved Howard Cosell. He wanted to be sort of the Howard Cosell of tennis, but he was so much more knowledgeable than anybody else about the sport that he would come up, and he had a great sense of humor. He never took himself that seriously, because I remember we were doing a show once in BBS. He started talking about a net court judge sitting there called Fingers Fortescue. And when we went to a break, I said, "But who the hell is Fingers Fortescue?" He said, "Oh no, don't worry about it. It's just a guy I made up. I made up his name. We'll just call him Fingers for short." And whenever he wanted to talk about something crazy, he'd say, "Well, Fingers would agree with that." And he's there. He's the net court judge. Well, now of course it's all done with machinery. There's no, like, but in those days it was a let court judge sitting on the court with his finger on the net waiting to field let courts. And Bud named him Fingers Fortescue, and that became a big deal on these telecasts. And that was all done with tongue in cheek. And that's the way Bud was. I mean, he'd do it, you know, a million of those things. But there's another serious side to Bud too. He was a very, very good writer. He loved being with the Boston Globe. And 1968, we won the Davis Cup in Australia. I was the captain, and Bud was on our team as sort of the writer in residence, traveling with the team. And we were sent to Saigon in Vietnam with the team. It was Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith, Bobby Lutz, Jimmy Osborne. We all went to, we had won the cup from Australia, and we were on the way back, and the State Department said, "Can you stop off and go to hospitals and visit soldiers and so forth?" They gave us two little Lear jets, and we split up into two groups and went all over the country. And General Westmoreland heard of us and called us into his office in Saigon. and gave us really about an hour briefing on the Vietnam War with the team and just one or two of the officers. And it was very detailed, and he answered questions and so forth. And so then we went back to our hotel. And the next morning, about 7 a.m., I get a phone call from the State Department. And they said, you know, is a Bud Collins around? Who is he? And what, is he traveling with the team or what? I said, yeah, Bud is officially with the team. He's been here in Saigon with us. Why? And they said, well, we want him out of the country by 5 o'clock tonight because he just wrote a scathing article damning General Westmoreland, saying he was trying to brainwash the Davis Cup team, and he wrote it for the Boston Globe, and it's all over the United States, and we're, you know, we're angry and embarrassed. So I went to Bud. I said, Bud, I'm not telling you what to write, but for God's sake, tip me off before you do something like that. And so we had to get him out of the country by 5 o'clock, which we did. And that officially ended his tour with the Davis Cup team. But he followed us, you know, for years. He was always very close and a great friend. But that was Bud. I mean, he just would write whatever he believed in and let the chips fall. And he was a damn good writer, but very funny. But Bud, underneath all of the joy and kidding and laughter, was a wonderfully warm human being. I mean, it was a fluky thing, but he and I had the same birthday, June 17th, just by a fluke. And so we would, when we were doing the broadcast a lot, we would always communicate on our birthday with each other with some kind of, you know, funny joke or funny card. But he was a guy that the sport cannot replace. I mean, he's a unique type of personality, and he was so warm and wonderful. He loved to play. I once played him in Thailand, and he was barefoot. He liked to play on grass barefoot. And I was beating him a little bit. We were betting lunch or something, and I was beating him, and he suddenly came to the net and complained bitterly that the ants were biting his feet and that he couldn't continue barefooted, therefore he couldn't play. And I said, well, that's fine, but then you are now defaulting, and I want lunch. And so we used to have that kind of relationship, and it was always fun and hilarious, but he was a really loyal, good friend. And as I say, underneath it all, he really loved people. That was his secret, and they loved him.
When was the last time you saw or spoke with him?
I spoke to Bud. I went and saw him in Boston after the Boston Marathon a year ago, and we visited him and Anita in their home. And then last week, on a Friday, I got a call from Anita saying that Bud was about to go into hospice, was not feeling well, and I said, can I fly up and see him? And she said, no, I don't think he's really, he's very sick and he's in bed and I don't think he'll recognize you, but why don't you just write me a letter? So last Monday a week ago, I wrote him a very, very long letter and sort of related all the things that I could remember that we had done together. And then she read it to him while he was in bed. So I always had felt good that, you know, she read it to him Monday or Tuesday, and he died on Friday. So I believe he heard it, and it was a love story in a way in the letter.
Not that it was shocking, because you knew he was getting ready to leave us, but when you got the word that he had passed, what was your feeling?
Well, there's a thundering void in your life, because you never see, you know, I don't know what's there after you die, but you never see him again in life here in America, and you just feel like when someone dies that you're close to, that leaves a tremendous void in your heart and in your mind. And I mean, Bud was really a special friend. I mean, when I was honored and put into the International Tennis Hall of Fame 2009, and they were looking for speakers all over the world to do things at this dinner that they gave in my honor, and I said, no, I want Bud Collins to be the master of ceremony, period, and there's nothing to talk about. So he flew down and did the ceremony that night with his wife, came down from Boston, was in Washington, and it was a big dinner. And he just was, you know, that kind of friend. I mean, we traveled a lot of places together. We went to South Africa when Arthur Ashe went and played in South Africa, and then he went and saw Mandela at Robben Island, Arthur did. Bud was on one of those trips. We made several to South Africa. So he was part of our life, and when you lose him, you just feel so... I don't know, just a big hole in your stomach.
How are you going to remember him?
Oh, that's easy. I mean, I just remember the voice and the joy and the laughter. But more importantly than all of that, the knowledge. He had a fantastic knowledge of the sport and he used it to promote the sport globally. And he was just beloved by, you know, when you say someone had many friends, this guy had thousands of friends because it's all the television, all the newspaper writing, and all the travel that he did.
He was an amazing guy, and I think his place in the history of tennis and in broadcasting will never be duplicated.
Well, think about it. He was the only writer in the International Hall of Fame. He was put in there in 1995. No, he's unique, and he's irreplaceable. You can't replace him. There's no way.
Absolutely right.
No one could replace him.
Don Dell, Bud's broadcasting partner for many years on PBS and NBC. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call and the memory of Bud. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you, Don.
Okay. Bye-bye.
It's been fun remembering Bud Collins this hour. We're going to take a quick break, coming back with much more after this. Rest well, Bud.
Hemmerly's Flowers and Gifts, address 615 East Center Street here in Marion. Telephone number 740-387-1163. Website hemmerlysflowers.com is a proud supporter of WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, Marion, Ohio.
This is Charlie Evers, and you can catch Marianne Michaels, Scott Spears, and myself every Friday, 12:10 until 1 p.m. for the Exchange Club, supported by Kroger, right here on WWGH 107.1 FM, streaming live on the internet.